Dallas Theological Seminary's Chapel Podcast.
Well, if you have heard, this is the Nathan D. Meyer Memorial Series in Bible Exposition, and our speaker this morning is Dr. Haddon Robinson. For those of you who were not here yesterday, let me introduce you to him. His title for this series is, Have You Heard the One About? He's an author, he's a pastor, he's been a professor. He currently serves as the Harold John Ockenghay Distinguished Professor of Preaching, and as well as being the Senior Director of the D-Min Program at Gordon-Conwell Theological Seminary. Prior to joining the staff and the faculty at Gordon-Conwell in 1991, he served for 12 years as the President of Denver Seminary, and prior to that taught at Dallas Theological Seminary for 19 years in the field of preaching. He's written extensively. His textbook on preaching continues to sell widely. He has published with Our Daily Bread, Bibliotheca Sacra, Christianity Today, Leadership, and Decision magazines. He's married to his wife, Bonnie. They live on the Southampton campus of Gordon-Conwell. And Bonnie is with us. And Bonnie, would you stand? And their daughter, Vicky, is here as well. Would you stand? And let me recognize both of you. And please welcome Dr. Haddon Robinson.
I'm always glad when Bonnie is invited. Everybody thinks more of me when they get the chance to meet her. I couldn't help but think, what a marvelous way to remember one of God's servants than to endow something like this. And then to see to it that someone like Zach has some money to help him along the way. You have all kinds of things that people remember. You have statues and birds, love them. You have plaques on the wall and nobody reads them. But this is a kind of a living memorial, something that's just marvelous. And I just wanted to say that. I appreciate the generosity and thoughtfulness of these donors. What I'd like to do this morning is give you a pop quiz. Nobody likes pop quizzes. Students don't like them. They take them by surprise. Faculty doesn't like them. They have to grade them. But today, I'm going to cut through all of the red tape. I'm going to give you a pop quiz. You grade yourself, and unless the dean says something otherwise, you're not going to get anything knocked off your final grade. Well, maybe something, but not enough to make a significant. Okay? Pop quiz. First question. What would you say we have to be in our relationship to God? Well, if your answer is in the words of Deuteronomy 6:5, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind, then you can give yourself some credit for that. The second question is, what is our responsibility towards our neighbor? That one came rather quickly, didn't it? Obviously, you have to love her too. And the New Testament would be hearty agreement. Paul says that love fulfills all the obligations of the law, that the evidence of God's Spirit working in our lives, among other things, were people of love. And when he wrote to the church in Rome, he told them, owe no one anything except to love one another. But the third question might be a bit more difficult, and that is, do you love God? I don't know what you would do with that, but probably you would think, yeah, I do love God. Deep down inside, I have a love for him. And I can't correct that, of course. If that's what you believe, then give yourself another 25 points. The fourth question, though. Who then, if you're to love him, who then is your neighbor? A little tougher. I mean, you'd say to me, do you mean the people who live in the dorm? Or how about married housing? And how about people outside the seminary, other people in the city of Dallas? I mean, why stop at the city limits, take in all the people in Texas? And, you know, I don't see why you'd stop at the state line. And before long, you'd have 300 million neighbors. But you said to me, it's a good question, but I don't know how to answer it. I don't know who my neighbor is. It's interesting that that same conversation comes to us from the 10th chapter of the Gospel of Luke, verse 25. A lawyer comes to question Jesus. He's not much in earnest. He wants to enhance his reputation as a scholar at the expense of a dull Galilean rabbi, sharp in his intellect on the razor strap of argument. So he has the conversation mapped out in his notebook at home. He knows how he's going to start, and then he imagines how Jesus will reply, then how he'll answer, and for long, in his mind at least, he has Jesus in an intellectual checkmate. He begins the conversation with one of the greatest questions men and women have ever faced. He says, "Teacher, what must I do to inherit eternal life?" A thousand philosophies lay strewn along the path of that question. And I admire the fact that Jesus doesn't take him up at his words. I mean, Jesus doesn't say, "That's a stupid question. What do you do to inherit eternal life?" In an inheritance, somebody wills it to you, and then they die so you can receive it, and then all you have to do is to accept it. But Jesus doesn't do that. Jesus says, "Well, you're a lawyer, you know the Old Testament law. What do you think it teaches?" And I think this man was very disappointed at the way Jesus responded. I mean, here he had come looking for intellectual dialogue. And Jesus is treating like a Sunday school kid in the third grade. I mean, everybody who grew up in the midst of the people of God knew the answer to the question, so he blurts out the reply. "You shall love the Lord your God with all of your heart, soul, strength, and mind, and your neighbor as yourself." Jesus said, "That's a good answer. You keep doing that, and you'll live." And this lawyer suddenly realized he had sprung his own trap. He was like a schoolboy, allowed to make up his examination, and then he had proceeded to flunk it. He didn't have any problem with that part about God. Everybody in the community knew how religious he was. It was that part about his neighbor that got under his skin. About that, he was not quite so sure. So he did in his day what you and I have done in our day. Face to face with a clear requirement of God, he asks for a definition of terms. Luke says that to justify himself, he said, "Well, who is my neighbor?" But we've done that, haven't we? I mean, how many times we will come face to face with what appears to be a pretty clear command of God, but instead of obeying it, we get a discussion group started. Because if we can talk about it long enough, just the right way, instead of bending our lives to the scriptures, we can, you know, turn the scriptures a bit, fit our lives. And that was the way he asked his question, "Who is my neighbor?" And when Jesus replies, he doesn't give him a long theoretical definition. He doesn't even remind him that there were three Greek words for love. Instead, he tells him a story. It's a story that lies on the pages of the scriptures like a booby trap. You pick it up, the story of the Good Samaritan, and as you handle it, it has a way of exploding, burying its truth deep inside your soul. You know the story. Jesus said, there was a man who was traveling from Jerusalem to Jericho. And he fell among thieves. Thieves pounced on him, beat him up, took his robe, took his money, and left him by the side of the road, half dead. And then Jesus said There were some men who also traveled that road. The two were a priest and a Levite. And if that poor wretch lying by the side of the road had made a list of candidates for a neighbor, that priest and a Levite would have been at the top of the list. Before they left their homes in the morning, tradition tells us, they quoted those two great sentences. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind, and your neighbor as yourself. So who would better qualify to be a neighbor than folks who knew those verses? But Jesus said the priest, the first one down the road, came and looked at the man and passed by on the other side. And you wonder how that could happen. I mean, how could one human being look at another human being in such terrible need and just walk past them? Well, I'm sure that that priest had some good, sound reasons for doing what he did, or at least reasons that sounded good. Since he was a priest, I'm sure they were religious leaders, reasons. I mean, I imagine he went back to the First Testament. And it says there that if a priest touches a dead body, he's ceremonially defiled. And he has to offer a sacrifice in order to be cleansed. And so I imagine this man thought, you know, I'd really like to stop. But it'd be just my luck for this man to die in my arms, and then I'd have to offer sacrifices. And a sacrifice costs some money. And besides it, people would wonder what I'm being cleansed from. Could hurt my testimony. For some reason, he passes by on the other side. Now, admittedly, I don't know that he thought that way. But I know that we sometimes do. There has been in the church across the years a doctrine built out of the idea that we're to be holy, that we're separate. So there are things that we cannot do, places we cannot go to, people we cannot embrace. So we have nothing to do with them. But often in the name of separation and holiness, we actually pass by the neighbor on our road to Jericho. That could be our neighbor. Second man down the road was a Levite. If the priest was like the pastor at the temple, then the Levite was like the assistant pastor. He kept the operation going and took care of the scrolls and did some ministry. And so he comes down the road. He looks, he sees the man, and he passes him by. You wonder what went through his mind. Well, maybe he thought like Levite, like priest. I mean, priest doesn't stop. I'm busier than he is. He's got more time than I do. Or maybe he thought, I'll jot this man down on a 3x5 card, and I'll use him as an illustration. When I get to Jerusalem, I will challenge the young people to start a Jericho Road Mission Society and come back here and help people like this. Okay, I'm not sure he said that. But I do know that whether he said that or not, we sometimes do. There has been an arithmetic in the church, numbers that have been spawned in the pit of hell. It's the kind of arithmetic that's so interested in reaching the world for Christ, it doesn't really see an individual. It's the kind of arithmetic that gets people challenged to go across seas, but really never crosses the street to see people who are hurting. Third man down the road was a Samaritan. That poor fellow by the road was making a list of candidates for a neighbor. Samaritan would have been at the bottom of the list. The Samaritans and the Jews hated each other. It was a deep, long-standing hatred, as deep as anything we see in Israel today between the Jews and the Arabs. or in Ireland between the Protestants and the Catholics. They were enemies. And yet, this Samaritan, coming down the road, sees the man, takes pity on him, gets off his donkey, gets down by the side of the road, and gets his hands bloody with his need, takes oil and wine and pours them in the wound and cleanses them, and then takes some cloths that he had and bandages them and takes them to a hotel. A lot of risk for a Samaritan to do that. It's sort of like an Indian in the 19th century who gets a wounded cowboy, puts him on his horse, takes him to an inn. Can't imagine what people would make of that, especially with a kind of head wound. But he does. He takes him to the inn. He sits up with him through the night, and then in the morning he leaves 2 denarii. It's 1 denarius would have been a day's wage for a single labor. He gives him 2. He leaves his credit card. He says, you know, if we give him anything else you need, and when I come back, we'll take care of it. And then Jesus said to this lawyer, who proved to be a neighbor to that man? That's who knew the verses, the guy who helped. And the lawyer, not being willing to take the name Samaritan on his lips, said, well, I guess the one who showed mercy. And Jesus said, right. Keep doing that. And you'll be satisfied. From this story, the Good Samaritan, we have the answer to the question, who is my neighbor? And the answer is as simple as it is profound. Jesus is saying that your neighbor is anyone whose need you see, whose need God put you in a position to meet. It's as profound as that. Your neighbor is anyone whose need you see, whose need God put you in a position to meet. There's some things we often put into neighbor that is not here. For example, your neighbor may be somebody you don't know. I mean, no evidence that this Jew, this Samaritan had ever met each other before. And one of the marks of the love of Christ and his people is that there are men and women who go to other cultures and other countries to meet needs of people they really don't know. But your neighbor may be somebody you don't know. Your neighbor may be somebody who's unfriendly. You go to talk to them and they slam the door in your face. Or they want to attack you. They have no gratitude. Your neighbor may be somebody unlovely. Nothing particularly attractive about a man lying in a pool of blood by the side of a dirt road. Your neighbor may be unrewarding. I mean, there's no evidence that this Jew who was helped ever paid the Samaritan back. All you can say from this story is that your neighbor is anyone whose need you see, whose need God puts you in a position to meet. And buried in the story, a certain way of looking at it that says this is what it takes to be a neighbor. One is you have to be involved. You have to take time. This Samaritan was not going down the Jericho Road because it was a holiday drive. It was a dangerous road, one of the most dangerous in antiquity. So He was on his way to a destination. He stops, gives time, gets involved. Boy, that's tough, isn't it? Like you, I live a kind of hectic, hurried, Harris life. It's easier for me to write out a check and put it in the offering plate than to get involved myself. But he gets involved. And it costs money to be a neighbor. I don't want to minimize that. He paid for the room rent, 2 days at least. Promised to give anything else that was needed. I mean, he gave his money, took his time, got involved with a man who was unknown, unfriendly, unlovely, unrewarding. Because your neighbor is anybody whose need you see, whose need God puts you in a position to meet. But there's a hook in that, isn't there? In that phrase, your neighbor is anyone whose need you see. Because the truth is, all three of these men saw the same thing. It almost seems that Luke has gone out of his way to say that. He said of the priest, he was going down the same road in verse 31, and when he saw the man, he passed by on the other side. And so too a Levite, when he came to the place and saw him, passed by on the other side. But a Samaritan, as he traveled, came to where the man was. And when he saw him, he took pity on him. All three of these men saw the same thing, a wounded stranger by the side of the road. One of them may have seen a ceremonial defilement. Another may have seen a good sermon illustration. Only the Samaritan saw his neighbor. So there's something lying under this, isn't there? What you are and who you are determines what you see. Just the principle of life. You and I go to an art museum. You love and appreciate art. I'm something of a clod. We stand before a picture and you say, Robinson, see that picture? Now that's art. And I say, that's art? Same picture. The difference is not up on the wall. Difference is on the inside. What you are determines what you see. When I was about 11 years of age, my cousin and I began to attend a church. They had a basketball team and we wanted to play basketball. We learned a great lesson that time, and that is that every silver lining has a cloud, because in order to play on the team, you had to go to Sunday school at least 3 Sundays a month. And during that time, I got waylaid into memorizing Bible verses. I had to memorize some of those nasty little verses back in 1 John. You know, the text says if you say you love God, don't love your neighbor, how can you love God whom you have not seen? And then not love your neighbor whom you do see. I memorized the verse. It didn't make any sense to me. I thought the whole thing was pious nonsense. It said that my love for God is reflected in my love for my brother, my sister. I didn't have a brother or sister, so I was kind of fortunate. But I had a cousin, and we were as close as brothers. And, you know, we didn't always get along. At times we would argue, get into fist fights, had personality clashes, you know. And this text is saying that if I say I love God and don't love him, I'm a liar. I couldn't. Well, I just dismissed it. It's just one of those things you learn in the Bible that nobody in his right mind would believe. As time went on, however, I discovered that John was onto something. I thought it was easy to love God. I mean, he's always working my side of the street. He was always kind, always gracious. I mean, it's easy. I discovered that the more I studied the Bible, that it isn't easy to love God. In fact, by nature, the heart rejects God. You and I no more search for God than a thief searches for a policeman. That if I am going to love God, it's because the love of God himself is shed abroad in my heart. And the same love that enables me to love my Father in heaven enables me to love my brother and sister on earth. That is, what you are will determine what you see. What you see will determine what you do. When you were growing up, you remember that bit of doggerel we learned? What was it? Pussycat, pussycat, where have you been? I've been to London to see the Queen. Pussycat, pussycat, what saw you there? I saw a little mouse sitting under her chair. Of all of the cities in the world that I have ever visited, I think that London is probably the greatest. There's the Tower of London with the blood of history soaking its bricks. There's the Westminster Abbey cradling its historic dead. There's the palace, residence of the Queen. The changing of the guard. Here's a cat who's been there. And now she is back home showing her pictures. And people crowd in. And I said, Pussycat, did you get to the palace? Got to the palace. Did you get inside the palace? Oh, yeah. Security for cats these days just isn't what it used to be. Well, when you got inside, did you see the Queen? Yeah, I saw the Queen. She was in residence. What's she look like? I mean, how does she wear her hair? What kind of clothes does she have? And the cat said, well, I didn't notice. You didn't notice? Pussycat, what did you see in the throne room of the Queen in the presence of Her Majesty? And the cat says, underneath her chair was one of the nicest little mice you would ever want to see. Why? Because if you've got the heart of a pussycat, mice are infinitely more important than queens. What you are determines what you see. And what you see determines what you do. My neighbor is anyone whose need I see, whose need God puts me in a position to meet. It's as simple and as profound as that. Well, let's go back to the pop quiz and then we'll quit. Do you love God? Good, I'm glad to hear that. Yeah, good. Those are good testimonies, wonderful. I like the way you sing about it, that's great. Do you love your neighbor? Because it is a kind of pious nonsense to prattle on about how much we love God whom we don't see and be blind to the needs of our neighbor whom we can see.